This is Audible.
It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
This is the second of a two-part interview conducted with David Bohm and recorded at the Ojai Foundation in Ojai, California. In the first interview, we were discussing David Bohm's unique idea of the dialogue process, and we'll be continuing our conversation and exploration of that idea in the first part of this second interview. David Bohm is considered one of the foremost theoretical physicists in the world. His book, Causality and Chance in Modern Physics, has become a classic in the field of quantum mechanics and is widely used at universities, as are his books on quantum theory and relativity. For more than two decades, he enjoyed a close association with Jay Krishnamurti, the late world-renowned philosopher sage, and they explored questions of mutual interest together. Certainly Krishnamurti influenced David Bohm's ideas, particularly those that we've heard in this first and now second interview. David Bohm is also the author of Wholeness in the Implicate Order and Science, Order, and Creativity, which he co-authored with David Peet, also a physicist. Join us for the next hour as we continue our exploration of the compelling and breakthrough ideas of physicist David Bohm. My name is Michael Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. In many ways, our whole society and culture is structured on the opposite of what you're suggesting. The kinds of ways we come together frequently are with set agendas. And
yes.
Even the places where we're supposed to have real dialogue, and I think of the arms negotiations and that kind of thing, it's really two agendas, and there's no real discussion of or openness to ideas and putting aside one's own position in many ways.
No, that's true. You see that. We can't see it in the dialogue. We can't have these fixed agendas. It's part of our cultural tradition that there's no point in meeting unless you have some fixed purpose, and then two sides have two different purposes that can't meet, right?
I mean, it's almost like irrational to do that.
Yeah, what?
To get together without an agenda.
No, that's the only rational way. You see that if you have an agenda, then you can never explore anything new. You see that's only within the limits of your agenda, which come from your fixed assumptions, right? Now, the two sides start from different assumptions, and therefore they really have different agendas, though they claim to have the same one, and they can't meet, right? Now, you see, in these, the basic assumptions, say, behind the Russian and the Western positions cannot be discussed, right? They can only discuss some minor points about how many bombs they're going to make or not make. But, see, if they could settle the basic issues between them, we wouldn't need these bombs, right? No, but they never consider that, right? Now, see, they're defending the basic issues, right? They never would never occur to them that we should really seriously discuss or dialogue about the basic issues and really see if we could get somewhere. Now, that would require, see, if you did that, there would be a kind of explosion, you see, very probably, because each one is committed to those issues. Now, see, we had a dialogue in Israel where we were talking about things, and somebody got up and said Zionism is getting in the way of Jewish-Arab relationships, and somebody else got up terribly disturbed and said without Zionism our country would go to pieces, and you know, he could hardly contain himself, and everybody got very excited. You see, now in that situation, if some people can come in who are tangentially, who are not that excited, it sort of diffuses it. You can get to look at it, right? if you have quite a few people. Whereas if you have a confrontation of a few people, one against the other, nobody can come in, you see. Now, so you sort of need quite a few different subcultures and points of view. See, if you just have West and East meeting, it'll be polarized. But if you could have intermediate points of view there, they might listen to each other. And you could start some real dialogue, and which would explore the basic questions which are dividing us. Now, unless we do that, I don't see any answer to this problem. You see, that we have, heaven knows, 60,000 nuclear weapons, bombs, and could destroy everything altogether. And if you think of 1,000 years, you think people are going to hold back that long?
We have enough weapons for equivalent to 2.5 tons of TNT for every person on the Earth.
Yeah, and then consider the destruction that would do to the ecology and the climate and, you know, to everything, and as well as to human beings and to the forests. And so if you say, well, for the moment the threat has receded, but time is long, you see, 1,000 years is a very short space in human history, and much less in evolution. And if you try to think of this balance going on 1,000 years, you see, so much can happen in 1,000 years. I mean, somebody crazy can get hold of these things, right? And therefore, it seems urgent to go deeper. You see, if we accept these divisions, there's no answer, you see. Now, in Northern Ireland, there are much smaller divisions have gone on for 350 years, and there's no answer yet, right? They can't really dialogue, right?
So we've talked about the field of science, and now we're talking about the field of politics. This really applies to all fields and professions and institutions, doesn't it?
Yes. It applies to everything. In principle, it would apply to all human relationships, that we really should be in dialogue constantly. See, for example, in the family, as it has developed, there's very little chance for dialogue, right? It has often been an authoritarian family, the family is organized around certain issues of, which, you know, keeping, you know, biological issues, you could call them, and there's very little occasion for really dialoguing. I mean, it must be fairly rare with all that, and yet the lack of understanding between generations or between people in the same generation requires dialogue. Right? You see, the families break up. People can't talk to each other, husband and wife, and they can't, the children and the parents don't really talk to each other.
So let's say you have a group of people, say 20 people. What do you start with? Where do you start? You say, well, we're just going to sit down and we're going to dialogue? And
well, I think I would start first. We would have to have somebody who has gone into this, someone has to be involved in direct and giving some sort of guidance at first. I mean, you know, they call it facilitator, whatever. I would start with some sort of seminar and dialogue to just discuss dialogue for a while, to give people a chance to see what would be involved in it. And then we would start talking. You see, advice I gave. See, people asked. Said, well, we had this seminar and dialogue, say in a certain meeting, and at a certain stage, people said, but what shall we talk about? So I said, just forget what we've said and talk normally. You see. And they did, you see, that it built up. At first, people were hesitant, but it began to build up, you see. And at first, it seemed impossible. And you see, whatever is important to you, you talk about, you see, because that's just the issue, which that's just where the problem is.
So that's what you mean by people expressing meaning.
Yes, because importance is meaning, right? You see, significance, value, and purpose, and see, people are not expressing what is their real values or what is significant to them or their real purposes. They're afraid what's going to happen, you see, that other people won't agree and they'll fight. And they keep away from it. Now, that means people are superficially related.
So there's no depth and no hope for really going beyond the problem.
Yeah, you see, they can discuss particular issues, but every issue has its roots in something bigger, you see, you can't. So let's try to put it this way. We may have all sorts of groups for solving particular problems, but we need to have a group that has no particular problem, an empty space, you see, a group which the word leisure in Greek originally meant empty space. That there's a kind of empty space where anything can go and where all this can happen.
When I was growing up, they used to talk about that we were going to have a lot more leisure time. And okay. I think leisure time, in, particularly in America, has become mostly filled with distractions.
Yes, well, I think
there really isn't any empty space.
No, people are frightened of that empty space because they're worried about what might happen there. They would like it all organized so it'd be sure it'll be all right. But you see, but that's just the point. The dialogue has is not fixed like that. It's not secure. There's a certain sense of insecurity in it, right? But if you don't have that, there's no room for creativity.
It sounds similar, it almost sounds similar to the Buddhist concept of emptiness, of coming at a problem with empty mind.
Well, there's a relation between them, but you see, it's essential here to bring this together, to coming at the problem together with an empty mind, you see, because the difficulty of civilization is that people, as I said before, cannot work together, cannot cooperate, cannot participate in any deep level, and it's all breaking up, fragmenting, you see, and it's getting very dangerous with modern weapons and so on. And we need, I'm saying that the whole of society has organized, as you say, to fill up everything, to occupy everything, and there's no space. Therefore, we can sort of not see all this.
David, continuing with the process of dialogue or the idea of dialogue, there's a possibility here of creating a new kind of community, isn't there?
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, I think that if people can go into this process of dialogue and face their difference of thought and opinion and get through that so they can all look at it all together and think together, and then there will be a different kind of mind. Well, first of all, I think I've said that there will be a sense of participation, a sense of fellowship, a different feeling. And there will be a liberation of intelligence. You see, this present approach of adversarial approach of, of opposition blocks intelligence. Each person is just sticking to his view, not really listening to the other one and just trying to repeating or finding new arguments or possibly finding a few points in common. But there's no real opportunity there for creative intelligence. Now, when all these special points of view are suspended, then the mind is open to move in creative intelligence. Now, therefore, it's a combination of a different feeling and a creative intelligence. A mind in which everybody is thinking together because everybody is holding all the different points of view in suspension.
What about individual creativity in the midst of the group?
Well, each person is participating and making his contribution. You see, insofar as he responds to what's happening, then he's making a contribution. So the individual is contributing and participating, as well as partaking of the spirit of the group and of the content of the thought.
So there isn't a subordination of the individual
to
the
group? There should be no leader. There may have to have somebody that gets it going and gives some advice in the beginning. But the ideal thing is that he should drop away and just participate. Now, the individual is not forced to conform to the group, but rather he makes his contribution freely. But at the same time, he's not trying to overwhelm the group or dominate it, you see. That is, it's not his purpose in making a contribution to assert himself, you see, primarily.
So is there any goal for the group to achieve? Do you enter into the group dialogue with a goal?
There's no specific goal. The only goal, you could say, a vague one, people must learn to talk together, right, as we've been discussing, learn to communicate and to share, right, participate in meaning. Now, but any further definition of the goal will get in the way because it means fixed assumptions. So people will have to talk without a goal. And as I've said, this is very foreign to our culture, because people only talk for entertainment or for a useful specific purpose. I should say that apparently something similar to this occurs in earlier forms of society, the primitive hunter-gatherer types.
I mean, I read a long time ago of an anthropologist who studied American Indians, and some of them are hunter-gatherers, and they in groups of about 20 to 40, they gather in a circle regularly, frequently and constantly, and they talk apparently to no purpose and make no decisions, and they just talk, but by keeping this up, everybody seems to know what to do, you see. They may get together for certain purposes in smaller groups, but there seems to be no visible purpose to this talking other than just sharing meaning, right? And often it's very egalitarian compared with our society, and there may be, you know, the older person may, you know, be respected for wisdom and so on, but I mean, this anthropologist friend told me that he found that they had far more freedom there than in our society, because nobody cared exactly what you thought as long as you didn't make too much of a nuisance of yourself. And you see, the thought was far freer in that sense.
How would you relate this, say, to an individual seeking therapy and being able to express themselves?
Well, it could, you see... It's a kind of therapy of society, right, of the culture. Now, say, the major difficulties we have in our time, or for a long time, have been difficulties of society, which are very chaotic, you see. And in fact, most of our people who are ill mentally are probably, it's primarily due to society, most neurosis, finally. And the... therefore, if you merely have therapy with the individual, you're really asking him, you're accepting the assumptions of society and trying to get him to fit in. But if the assumptions of the society are themselves not really sane, then that's a very limited sort of thing to do. Right? Now, you could say that we start out with people coming into the group, different subcultures and all sorts of conflicts and all the crazy assumptions of society which begin to come out. And insofar as people can face these in a friendly way, you know, the spirit of friendship is strong enough to face the high temperature, then this begins to go, you see, and in a way, therefore, healing in the sense of making whole this subculture, this microculture we have here, right? So this microculture becomes a kind of new instrument of mind, which is intelligent and friendly and perhaps compassionate.
Yeah. Where did you first start to get on to your interest in the dialogue process?
Yes, well, to a certain extent, Krishnamurti was interested in having dialogue, but it was either one-on-one or in groups, but it was primarily directed toward him, right? That he would say, let's have a dialogue, meaning not that people should answer him back, although they could, but he wasn't really inviting that, but rather that the other person would listen to Krishnamurti free, openly, and also listen to his own response, but suspending it both, and you know, not believing Krishnamurti or his own, and just looking at it. So that's more accurately, I think, called thinking together with Krishnamurti and yourself. And now I think that's the sort of thing that would be possible on a program like this. If we have a dialogue, then people who are listening could do that, a kind of participation. Right? But the notion of dialogue on a very on a larger scale, you know, and with a greater objective was greater meaning. Rather was I got from a man called Dr. Patrick DeMary, who lives in London, England. And he practiced, he is retired now, but he was practicing there as a psychiatrist. And during the last World War, he worked for the British Army, you know, in hospitals, and he began to work out along with Fuchs, yes, a man called Fuchs, too. A way of a therapy which involved large groups. In fact, they involved the whole hospital staff and doctors and patients. And after that, he began to apply it on a smaller scale, and he began to see that it was had a wider significance than therapy. And he began to point in the direction which I've been describing.
Here we are, we're doing this conversation, having this dialogue on the grounds of the Krishnamurti Foundation, and I'd like to take this opportunity just to ask you about your own interaction with Krishnamurti, and how do you feel that that interaction has influenced your own work?
Well, yes, let me say that I was oriented in many ways toward the things that Krishnamurti is doing before I met him, in the sense that in physics I was the quantum mechanics, which raises the question of the oneness of the observer and the observed, and the whole question of fragmentation and so on. That is, all of these had been interesting to me before. And so what Krishnamurti, the first meeting with Krishnamurti, I even felt an interest in thought and looking into thought. But with the first meeting with Krishnamurti, I felt that, and reading his material, I felt that we could really extend this whole thing to the whole human mind and the whole of human society. You see, and that it was, he was seriously proposing it and trying to bring it about. And this had a very great effect on me. And I went much further into it through my contact with Krishnamurti. So he really raised the idea of the transformation of the whole human consciousness, which I'd sort of been in the back of my mind and had believed, for example, that changes of society might have done it. But by that time I was beginning to see in the early 60s that they won't do it. That he said we've got to directly look at the human mind itself, that that's the thing on which everything depends.
Krishnamurti talked about going beyond thinking.
Yes.
And we've been talking about thought.
Yeah.
So how do you think and involve yourself with thought and go beyond thinking?
Well, you see, the first point is that through thought you get to understand, with the aid of thought anyway, you get to understand this thinking process, right? Which we also require observation. I think I've already suggested that, but I could say there's something which Krishnamurti calls meditation. Now, that word has so many meanings that it's hard to know what it will convey, but let's say roughly it means you begin by being sensitive to how you're and aware of how your thought process is actually working, and you don't necessarily accept any of it and nor reject it. It's a little bit like what we're saying about dialogue, but you suspend the thought process in the same sense and look at it and begin to see how it works and see what's going wrong, and you know, the mere seeing of this is enough to change it. It doesn't require any further special action to see that it makes no sense, it finishes, right? And the same will happen in dialogue, you see, to see that certain ways of responding make no sense changes them. So whereas ordinarily in ordinary affairs we have to say time is required, we have the end and the means, we project an end and we try by means, have some means to achieve it, right? Now the crucial point Krishnamurti is saying is the change of thought will not occur that way, not through time, in the sense of time as a goal, right? That time is not the essential point, but rather intensity of perception. Now, as you begin to see the disorder in thought, it begins to drop away, then in the very act of seeing the disorder calls into play something beyond thought, which we can call, in the first instance, awareness and attention. Right? Say, awareness is a kind of sensitivity to differences and similarities, which is already beyond thought. It means watchfulness, wary. And then attentiveness, the attention or attentive, it has to be unrestricted attentiveness. Our ordinary attention is restricted according to our thought. Now, in order to be able to watch thought, we have to have an unrestricted attention, because you cannot watch thought with attention that is restricted by thought. It doesn't mean you can't use thought, but you cannot be controlled by thought, or limited by thought. And so this attention will begin to feel out, the awareness and attention begin to feel out and bring out what is happening with thought, right? Now, as that dies away, then order begins to come. Because we would say order is natural, but this disorder is due to this confused process of thought, which has to come to order, right? So in bringing order about, not only in thought, but in all your daily life, which is in which thought is heavily involved, therefore the mind begins to change. That is what Krishnamurti says. And it begins to open the way, open the door to something much greater.
So in a sense, it's getting rid of the excess baggage that we carry around from our previous existence? Is that it?
Yes, it's not merely excess baggage, but it's harmful baggage. It's actually doing us harm. It's not merely that it's unnecessary.
Yeah. It's weighting us down. It's filling up our minds.
Yes, it's occupying the mind and confusing it and leading us into destructive processes.
So we're talking about clarifying the mind.
Yes. Quite, and it becomes more silent then, open and sensitive, right?
Why is it, do you think, that most of us are afraid of that space? And it does seem to be a common characteristic.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to know. I think it's part of our culture. You see, part of our culture is to say that we have great faith in things, you see. Now, the word thing is an interesting derivation in Latin. The word real, the root in Latin is res. The word res means thing, right? So reality would be all things, probably. But then that is root based on the verb reri, R-E-R-I, to think. So at that rate, you would say things are what you could think about, right? And therefore, thought we know is cloud. You know, it's a vaporous, unsubstantial
amorphous
thing.
Yes.
You can't count on it. So we say we've got to have things, right, to count on, right? And we can think about things and set them up. And we have confidence, you know, feel secure with those things, or possessions or houses or whatever it is. And then, the word nothing strikes terror because you say, I don't want to be nothing. I don't want to have nothing. I better have something, right? But you see, the word nothing may mean just something vacuous and worthless, but it also means no thing. That is the emptiness of clarity. In the emptiness of clarity, there is no thing cluttering it up, right?
So this may be what the Buddhists talk about, the no-thingness.
Yes. Now, but you see, the whole background creates terror around that because it's the idea of privation, of loss of everything and suffering, and, you know, that's all connected. See, we have had such a history of all that there's a terror of removing those things on which we depend. Now, they're not trying to say you shouldn't have things such as food and shelter and so on, but we're overdoing it. Now, we are using things to create a sense of psychological security when we're actually doing ourselves a lot of harm. You know, and using far more things than we need and so on.
Krishnamurti even suggested, and he himself claimed that he didn't have a memory. He didn't remember things.
Well, that's not quite so simple. I mean, he does remember it fairly well. There was a period when he lost his memory. I don't know too much about it, but he had a big change occurred at a certain phase of his life. And he lost, he doesn't remember too much of certain parts of his life. But when I was older, he could see that he was perfectly well remembering what had happened, even a year ago. You know, he had ordinary memory. But I think he wanted to emphasize not to give too much importance to memory.
Mm-hmm. So again, being a pattern that we carry with us.
And because it's the memory which is what clutters us up. It's not the things themselves. You can't take them into your mind. It's the memory of them. You know, and the thought which says you may not have them.
I'm speaking with David Bohm, physicist and author of Wholeness in the Implicate Order and co-author of Science, Order, and Creativity. We'll be back in 1 minute. One of the aspects that permeates our conditioning and our culture is the idea that there's an objective reality.
Mm-hmm.
What is your commentary or view of objective reality?
Well, I think that's a very subtle question. If you remember what I said about the word reality, it means all things, right? The whole quality of thinghood, and that stand independently of thought, right? But you're nevertheless able to think about them, right? That reality is what you can grasp in thought and limit in thought, and find its limits in thought, right? Now, see, one view would be to say there's nothing else. Now, I think there is a kind of objective reality because we could all agree on certain things. And we agree they don't depend on our way we think about them. And therefore, we can't dismiss the category of objective reality altogether, you see. But we may perhaps carry it too far. Now, the object sort of stands independent of thought, independent of the subject. You see, the subject and object are correlative notions. Right? One implies the other. Now, the subject, the word I stands for the subject. Right? And the word me stands for me as object, or you. It could be subject or object. Right? Or that, see, this house is an object. Right? We don't think it's a subject, though some primitive earlier peoples may have thought the tree was a subject, or that the whole world was a subject, and in religions that's really implicit. Now, the subject is supposed to be active, the one who determines everything, you know, who is in relation to everything, who is identical, and so on. Now, the subject seems far more vital in some sense than the object. Right? And people really value the subject. The object is valued really because of its significance for the subject. Right? I mean, because of what it does for you. So now, and insofar as we try to devalue the subject, we will be taking away some of the value from life. Right? So we need to consider both. Now, modern science tends to devalue the subject or even wants to eliminate it. I don't think that can be done. You see, I think that mind and spirit, or whatever you want to call it, goes beyond what could be grasped in thought, you see. I would call it the unlimited, because thought is what anything that could be grasped in thought has got to have limits and boundaries. And so I'd say that there is the unlimited, which, and this unlimited must include the limited, or else it would be limited, you see. So everything is basically of that nature, but our thought makes abstractions. Right? Like, you see what I mean? It takes out some irrelevant aspect, but our thought is never equal to the whole thing. It's both less and more. It's less, obviously, you can't eat the thought of dinner, but it's more because it has, you can do some other things with that thought, right? Like reason with it. Now, so you could say that thought forms a representation of whatever you want to call it, of reality. It is not reality itself. It represents it. It presents it again abstractly in the mind, and that's like a map. It will guide us in our action toward whatever that is. So, but I don't think we can form a representation of the subject in thought, and not one that's adequate. And that's where the trouble is. We try to do so. See, because people are led to, they say the world is made of nothing but objects. And in order to organize society, we've got to treat people as objects. You treat yourself as an object by the word me. But then the subject, which is supposed to be unlimited, is equated, identified with the object, and that makes a contradiction, right? That they're constantly feeling the object is limited, it ought to be unlimited. And therefore you have egotism. People want to get more, right? Be bigger and stronger, be the greatest. So I think that this trend in modern society to eliminate the subject is wrong. I mean, it simply can't work, and it's not appropriate. But the objective side is that there's certain things, whatever they may be, which don't depend significantly, which we can agree on in common and don't depend significantly on how we think.
Well, I'm thinking of relative to dualistic thinking, the idea of us and them, you and me. And in some ways, that's part of the problem, isn't it?
Yes, it's part of the problem. You see, because if I think of I as the subject, then you are an object, right? And I could then manipulate you use you as a means to my ends, right? Or I may even think of myself as I split myself in two, say I am the subject who has will and desire, and I am also an object who must be manipulated to satisfy that will, right? Now that creates a conflict. But since we've said that we're all really participating together, even to say that about you creates a conflict, or even to say it about nature creates a conflict, right? So we must limit ourselves in how far we say nature is an object, right? That could be manipulated at will.
Well, in some sense, as long as we think that way,
Yeah.
We're not able to come to wholeness, are we?
No, because we have spent every object as separate, and I'm another object who is separate. And besides that, I'm a subject who is different from myself as object. And you are both subject and object, and it all gets very fragmented. You see, so we can't, and it will create tremendous conflict, and since the subject has unlimited value, it's going to give tremendous energy to the conflict, right? Now, we can't have harmony that way. Now, there's another way to think, which is that whatever we say anything is, it isn't, you see. It's an abstraction. It may be more than what we say or different. That what we say is a representation of whatever is, but it is not what is, right? All right. Now, therefore, we could say you have any number of representations, some better than others. For example, science had a certain representation of nature in the 19th century. It's got another one in the 20th century, but in the 21st it may get another one, right? See, representations have no special character. They're not sacred, or they don't grasp reality exactly as it is, right? Now, if we think of it that way, and I say, well, however I think of you, that is only a representation. However I think of me, or society, or of nature, it is only a representation. And we therefore have to be open not only to changing the representation, but to a kind of sensitivity which is beyond thought, which enables us to do it. You know, that we say basically we're in the unknown, in the immeasurable, in the unlimited, and every action is directed toward it, but our thought can engage the unlimited in a certain way. You see, by means of this representation, we can direct our action toward the unlimited, because everything is the unlimited, right? Underneath. In that sense, we could come to consistency, because we're not going to try to know everything or dominate everything. But we just simply say we are there participating in the whole. And that's participating in us.
So how do you think that's going to come about? What do you think is... do you have any views on how to bring this idea of going beyond dualistic thinking into reality?
There are several steps. You see, one thing is you can go into the dualistic thinking and see its incoherence, see it show rationally that it's not very coherent. But I think that the two ways I can think of it are really one way. One way is what, let's say, by being observant as an individual of your own thought. You see, the trouble arises from your thought, right? Which is, as you say, dualistic. It sets up the object and the subject, you see, the observer and the observed, right? Now, these are all one, really, but we don't experience them as one, because thought affects how we see things and experience things. And once we think that way, we're going to see it that way, especially after it happened so many, it's gone on so many centuries, you see.
So to start to notice that, how we see things.
Yes, and how we see ourselves, and how we see our thought, how we see society. So that we begin to be familiar with that and suspend our thought, our dualistic thought, as an individual. And then the other side is to do it together in a group, right?
Back to the dialogue.
To the dialogue, where we will establish that sort of mind on a higher level of the whole group, right? Which will be more powerful, I think, once it's done. I see that to be able to do that, we might call not just communication, but communion.
In some ways, this whole idea implies some kind of sense of outside of time and space.
Yes.
Is that what we're going for, to really move ourselves beyond the concept of time and space?
Yes, time and space are representations, you see. And time is very clear because, you see, let's think of time. The past is gone, right? The future is not yet, right? Now, we often represent time as on a line, you see. So we say, here's a point on that line, this point in time, now. But that point separates what has already gone from what does not yet exist. So how can it be? You see, that shows that this notion of time is very abstract. It is not really directly what is, but it is a representation, like a map, right? In fact, we are representing time by space, right? That line is space, really, and not time. Now, because there's a certain similarity between the order of space and the order... Time is the order of succession, and space the order of coexistence, as Leibniz has said. Time is the order of successive existence, right? So we represent that order by means of the concept of time, right? And space we represent by means of concepts of distance and angle and so on. See, that these are all represented, and that representation fuses with our perception, so we don't realize we're using it, which has been developed by the human race over thousands of years and tens of thousands, and we are just using it, you see. We're just happening, you see. It's unconscious, right? So time and space are representations which are very necessary, and we know we're not discarding them or anything, but we want to see what do they really mean. They do not mean the way it is, but they are a way of representing it so we can order it and organize it and know what we're doing, right? Now, what is the mind in time and space, you see? It seems hard to see what space, not a certainly ordinary space, our thoughts are, don't seem to be in ordinary space. And are they? But they seem to be in time, right? But are they? See, if the past is gone, the future is not yet, this moment is all there is, right? And then there'll be another moment which succeeds it, and another one. But the time in between, what about? You see, psychologically, there may be no time in the sense that we represent it for material objects. It may not be a good representation. And you can see that because to change a psychological problem, it cannot happen in time, you see. If you are committed to doing something stupid, you know, you can't change it by saying, I'm going to struggle to stop myself from being stupid, you see. I mean, you have to drop it right then and there, right? Now, it's tied up with this question of object. You see, to treat yourself as an object implies that you exist in objects have continuity through time, right? So you're then assuming that you, that the subject, since the subjects identify with the object, you're assuming the subject has a continuous existence in time. Now that may be a mistake, you see. Maybe it sort of comes in and out. It's like the television image. The object which crosses the screen does not exist in time because it's constantly being created, you see, from the electron beam. You know, very fast, so you don't see it. So the subject may not be the sort of thing that exists continuously in time, but our thought represents it as existing that way, and therefore we're satisfied it does. But if you try to find it, you can't, right?
So what are the implications of that? I mean, implications of moving beyond the current conception we have of time?
Well, and space and of existence continuously. You see, if there is a space, it's of another kind, right? And it means that time is, you see, that we cannot give time as the highest value, right? That you cannot find meaning in time. Now, there was in the Mikado, you know, there was the Lord High Executioner. Remember his phrase, my object all sublime I shall achieve in time to let the punishment fit the crime. And you see, the object seems very small compared with what he's aiming for. But you can see that the very fact that he made that rhyme shows that he was reflecting a common view. He's making fun of it, wasn't he? That you're going to achieve the sublime in time. Now, the suggestion is it cannot be, that's not the way, right?
So what you're implying is that there is literally an immortality.
Well, it's really that what we call, it has often been said, that the real meaning of eternity is not the totality of time, but now, right? See, every moment now is essentially eternity, right? If you go deeply into the moment, all the differences, abstracting from all the differences, then essentially they're all one, right? You see, it's only the differences which make this moment different from another one. But if you lost your memory, you know, you couldn't know them, and then you wouldn't know about time at all, right?
So what do you think? The words become strange to use after this conversation, but what do you think the individual consciousness represents in the context of what we've been talking about?
Well, I think it's affected by the collective representation. You see, the way in which we experience individual consciousness is affected by the collective representation of what an individual is supposed to be, right? Which we pick up from the society unconsciously. that we are such and such a person with such interest and such goal and such permanence.
You're suggesting we'd have to unlearn that.
You know, we have to see it, not only unlearn it, but actually see how it works so that we can see that it has no ground. You see, if we once see that it has no ground, then it has no power over you, right? It's all this thought. Now, thought has no ground, finally. It's just memory, you see. The only ground we could give it is reason, saying it fits together or else it fits a fact, right? But there is no fact. It doesn't make sense reasonably, and there's no fact which is behind that. So it's sort of empty thought.
So in that sense, nothing makes sense.
What? Well, the way Krishnamurti would have put it, if we use the word no thing, mm-hmm. he says in no thing is complete security. Anything can, no thing can get.
So no thing makes sense.
Yes, well, no thing makes sense, but anything cannot make sense as a source of security. Everything is limited, and you can't count on it. Even diamonds are supposed to be forever, but they can burn up, you see. So things always change, you can't count on them, and you change. So he's saying it's only in that moment, that no thing, which is beyond time, that you are secure, right? That is what you really are, in essence, is secure, though the body may or may not be, right? As you maximize the security of the body, but you cannot never get perfect security for the body. It's going to die anyway, and as well as other things happen. Now, but if you say, what am I really? What is it really most essential about me, you see? One view is to say it's the body, right? But people don't really act that way. They seem to think there's something inside consciousness that is more valuable. You see, if you were living in a coma for 50 years, it wouldn't have any meaning. So the consciousness seems to be important, you see. But what is this consciousness? We don't know. Now, it doesn't seem to be based on time, really, because of what I've said, right? Now, if you say, have a ground beyond all the things we talk about, ordinarily the things, that is, and beyond no thing, right, and no thing. And in that case, that which is essential in us doesn't die, right? That is, what dies is a certain form. It's not clear whether it means you survive as an individual or not, but you say whatever you are, which is essential and alive, does not die, right? That's the suggestion. And it is not even in time. But that which animates us, which really, see, without which we wouldn't, our life, even if we were physically alive, it wouldn't mean much, right?
So, do you see, here you are, a physicist, and essentially speaking like a mystic would speak, do you see science and mysticism coming together eventually? In a way that the two fields are really one?
Well, I think it's potentially possible. You know, that at present, science is not moving that way. That's a particular feature of our culture. I think that the new things that have been discovered in science favor that view.
Like so, what?
Like we discussed the implicate order and things like that. And they're more favorable than, say, classical Newtonian physics was. Quite a bit more favorable.
Now, certainly Rupert Sheldrake's theory of morphic resonance.
But that, again, that's true, but it isn't commonly accepted. Again, you see,
yes,
I'm saying that there are possibilities for this to happen, that what you call mysticism, you see, but what does the word mean? It means hidden, literally, but see, they would say it's not a question of anything being hidden except what the consciousness is hiding from itself by all this chaotic movement, right? That we would rather call it clarity rather than hiddenness, right? So you're saying ordinary consciousness is the state in which most things are hidden from that view. And therefore, we could say that there could be a state of clarity.
In some sense, we're really talking about metaphysics in some way, aren't we?
Well, yes.
Beyond the current conception of physics.
Yes, yes. That's one possible meaning of metaphysics, you see. Metaphysics and philosophy is the discussion of the nature of reality. But, it can be given this other meaning. What we're talking is beyond what can be grasped in thought, you see. It's not only beyond science, but it's beyond thought as a whole, right? But thought may take part in it. It participates in it, but it does not grasp it. Do you see the difference? It does not mean that we discard thought or devalue thought, or say we should never think. But rather, thought is not dominant. It is merely participating in something more.
And certainly with technology and the Industrial Revolution, I mean, we've basically empowered thought and the rational mind as the end-all and be-all.
Yes, and the rational mind is not very rational, finally. You see that whatever is the rational part is at the service of very irrational impulses. So we've put everything in the power of thought, and thought can, and thought has made the assumption it can grasp everything and order it and so on, but it can't. You see, not only we see that it's not leading anywhere. You see, if you take all this technological progress of the past 50 years, who would say that people are happier now than then? People are more worried about the future than ever. And the fact that more technological progress could worry us still more, because destruction could be still greater. Unless we bring to order this human mind, which is behind it all, this technology can't help us and may even make it worse.
But in some ways, in your suggestion of going beyond thought and thinking as we know it, but being able to use it in a new way, implies also, in some sense, a dissolution of one's ego identity and one's identification with a personal self.
Well, it may, at least in some measure. You see, I think that the present ego identity, it doesn't mean you don't have a self event. It's not clear whether you would have an individuality. You would still be an individual. But the present ego identity is based, I think, on a wrong mode of thought, you see, in which a person identifies with his thoughts and with his body and with things, do you see? And which means that he's creating an illusion, right? That this self which people feel they have is not, is only a show. It is not really there, but it is such a convincing show that everybody acts as if it were there, and that gives it an apparent reality. Do you see what I'm driving at? Therefore, it's not a matter
of... we're supported for what we believe ourselves to be.
Yes. As we believe it so intensely that we create a phenomena as if it were there, right? And that seems to prove it. Now, but it's so full of contradiction, I think, I don't know if I have time, I wouldn't have time to go into all that, but if you go into it, you can see it's a mess of contradiction, and that this self that we commonly call the self is really, we could call it the thought of the self, really, or the I thought, and that creates this manifestation, this set of phenomena. Now, that I say that is not that has no ground, right? The Buddhists say that too, I think. And what really is there, we would have to discover. But as long as that's filling the field, we can never find out. Right? But it might not. We might have some sort of genuine being of some kind, which is rather being confused by this thing, right?
Well, the mind is a very tricky instrument. In some ways, we've allowed the mind to basically become our ruler.
Well, it's thought, I would say, is a ruler. Thought. In some sense, it's almost mindless thought, you see. That thought has become the ruler, and thought, by saying thought is all there is, thought can cover everything, it implies thought is the ruler, right?
Yes.
And that, I don't think thought can work that way. You see, it cannot rule. It will just be chaos if thought tries to rule. It's got to participate.
In many ways, we have chaos as we look around us.
Yes. Yes, I mean, we have all that. We've discussed this fragmentation, this breakup of everything. It's thought that has broken it up, this thought which is taking over. And so once again, we don't treat that thought as representation. We treat it as just a copy of what is, right? So if you say somebody is, you know, somebody, the people of this nation are evil, you say that's just what they are, right? You're not representing them as evil, you see. Because you could then see it's rather silly to just represent people as evil, because But see, these thoughts about ourselves and about other people and about nature are representations. If we could take that seriously, it would change the whole nature of thought.
What do you think it would take for us to take it seriously?
Well, we've got to do this kind of work, I was saying, sustained work on ourselves and in groups.
So both individual work and group work in the dialogue process.
Yes. Now, we really have got to have the firm intention to do it, you see, which means we see the value of it, you see. People can have often, I like to make this analogy, those people who climbed Mount Everest had a very strong intention, they thought it was very high value, and they did it. They didn't get distracted by getting halfway up and finding they were tired or had something else to do or sick or whatever. But if they did, then they wouldn't do it, right? Now, I'm not saying it was a good thing they did it. It's just merely an illustrative example that's good to look at. But that's the sort of spirit you need, right? Now, see, if you have that spirit, then I think you can do it.
Where do you see your work taking you in the future, David?
I'm going to go on with my scientific work in physics to develop new ideas on the quantum theory in space and time, which would be more in line with what I've been saying. And then I want to, we're having dialogues here, discussions anyway, we'll call them seminars here at Ojai and other places on thought. We might have some books on that. And then I want to see if we can do something with dialogue. I mean, I think these are all three different phases of the whole one thing, right?
David, thank you. It's been good talking with you.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with David Bohm, world-renowned physicist and author of Wholeness in the Implicate Order, and co-author of Science, Order, and Creativity, available in paperback from Bantam Books. My name is Michael Toms. On behalf of the New Dimensions radio staff and all those who are members or friends of New Dimensions, I'm wishing you well.
This is program number 2182.
For more information about the work of David Bohm, go to www.davidbohm.net, DAVID-BOHM.net.
New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. Since 1973, New Dimensions Radio has produced programming covering the history of the future. For more information and a complimentary copy of the New Dimensions newsletter, or to order an audio copy of today's program using American Express, Visa, Discover, or MasterCard, call 1-800-388-8273. That's 1-800-388-TAPE. Or visit our website, newdimensions.org.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.